Microsoft tells foreign countries no security for you. Under 13, you're banned from Facebook. And 4G comes to Johnstown. All that and more on the Slongcast. This week's edition of the Slongcast for Tuesday, March 29th, 2011. This week's episode of the Slongcast is brought to you by the Jonas Brothers, making you realize that Hanson wasn't so bad. I'm your host, Kevin Slonka, and with me as usual, Mr. Ryan Lancey.
Hey, how's it going? New, fancy, and with compression.
With compression.
Not the digital kind.
No, the analog kind.
Yes.
So Ryan's referencing, I have a compressor set up now. It's kind of crappily set up here in the studio, but I'm actually using it the right way. I got an insert cable, and we're snaked in.
Yeah, so let us know if our voices sound better, worse, or
yeah, so here's how you know. So I'm speaking very softly right now, and it sounds at a normal volume. And now I'm yelling into the microphone, and it only gets a little bit louder.
Yeah, it's not like crazy loud.
Right, so your speakers should not have crackled or anything right there because the compressor cut me down.
Yep.
So hopefully this should equalize our voices a little bit, and hopefully sometime in the future I'll get another compressor so that whenever we have a third guest, you know, they can also be compressed, because right now I only have two channels of compression. More money out of my pocket. So anyways, let's start off with our top story of the week. Microsoft shuts off HTTPS in Hotmail for over a dozen countries.
Evil.
Is it though?
I don't know.
So this article from the Electronic Frontier Foundation mentions that in some of these countries that Microsoft considers terrorist countries, Bahrain, Morocco, Algeria, Syria, Sudan, Iran, maybe not necessarily terrorists, but countries with major political problems that affect the United States and we don't like them necessarily.
Also evil.
Yeah. So in those countries, Microsoft removed the option for HTTPS in Hotmail. They're like, you know what? If you're going to be terrorist, your email was wide open. So what do you like? I mean,
I'm making faces. I don't know. I mean, I think it was an accident. At least that's what it sounds like. And
really, you think it was an accident for them to remove HTTPS for these like 12 specific countries?
Well, I bet it's not a specific thing. It's probably that they're like, you know, they're probably like grouped into some kind of like template that they
like
have.
An area of the world template kind
of
thing.
It might not even be area. It might be like types of countries. And because of that, like, I don't know. Maybe they have some kind of like, you know, it's like a template that they apply to certain countries.
Yeah, that's, I don't know. I mean, I necessarily think that Microsoft is taking a political stand.
Hmm.
I'm probably completely wrong with that.
Probably.
But because I'm wrong with everything. But the EFF basically just says, you know, no matter what Microsoft is doing, we have this plugin called HTTPS Everywhere that we've been telling you about for the past 6 months. Use that.
Yeah, why not?
Because, I mean, really, you know, this has multiple impacts. Okay, terrorists in those countries, their email is wide open, so now we can snoop on them. But there are good people in those countries, too. And now they don't have the option for secure email.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know which way I stand on this, but if Microsoft is taking a political stance, I say be careful.
Yes, be careful.
So our next article dealing with security, I believe you submitted, Ryan.
So interestingly enough, a very prominent and very well-known security system known as TLS, like SSL, all this stuff. It's used in websites. There's some questions about their reliability, and there's a Komodo certificate fraud that they're using as maybe an example of how we might have to call into question the whole like certificate of authenticity, you know, trust mechanism.
Because this was kind of crazy.
Yeah, I'm sorry, certificate authority. That's the proper term for that. Yeah, basically, there's a lot of ways that you can, you know, break down SSL, but this one really calls into question the way certificates are given out by the root CAs, And it's pretty interesting. I mean, have you looked into it? Like, do you know anything about it?
Yeah. What made this interesting is that, you know, normally certificates are given out from regional certificate providers. So, you know, somebody like VeriSign, they have the root certificate, and they give access to this to all of these regional providers. And when individual websites need certificates, they go to these regional providers who can give you an SSL certificate based off of the root certificate. But that's not what happened here. You know, what was hacked, the certificates were generated straight from the root. So somebody like got access to the main certificate, and it's kind of crazy because I don't know if you read any future articles on this, but one lone Iranian guy is saying he did it. He's like, this wasn't government motivated. The government didn't do it. It was me. I have the prowess of 1,000 hackers. I have the knowledge of 1,000 people. It was me.
Yeah. Well, the other interesting thing that I read in this article was related to this certificate revocation list. And this is a feature that was supported by SSL so that when certificates were invalidated, they could revoke them. But there's nothing really enforcing that the regional CAs like enforce this correctly, I guess. In that case, like if your like software is pointed to one of these regional CAs, then say, you know, a government could possibly surreptitiously circumvent this by, you know, asking the CA to issue a false certificate, and then they could use it, you know, against their own people.
Yeah, the revocation only works as long as the people running the regionals, you know, not verify, but use the revocations and say, okay, these certificates, the next time somebody checks in with them, we tell them they don't work anymore.
Yeah.
So if they don't do that, then yeah, it's kind of like fake SSL. And it's
interesting. So there's, you know, there's some, this article from Ars Technica, there's some, you know, they surmise some different possible replacements for this process. And it's interesting. I think it's a good read. And it may just start to question, you know, everyone needs to really call into question our trust in this whole, you know, root CA process and with the way SSL works.
Yeah, and what also was interesting was how browser manufacturers handled this. So mostly everybody, you know, normally a revocation should be enough. That's how certificates are handled. You revoke them, they don't work anymore. But a lot of the browser companies, you know, Mozilla, one of them, they released a new build of Firefox with these, what were they, 9 certificates specifically denied, specifically revoked in the code of the browser.
Yeah.
So that they couldn't use it. And I believe Microsoft did it with Internet Explorer. You know, pretty much every major browser released a patch.
Yep.
To specifically deny this. And that is the complete wrong way to go about doing it. But, you know, as you mentioned, the right way of revoking, not everybody has to pay attention to it.
Yeah, I mean, it basically, it's just that, you know, what this really article is really getting down to is that the method, what makes SSL work is not only the encryption or the validation, which could be circumvented by a man-in-the-middle attack, it also enforces this, you know, this trust between computers, and it's an inherent trust that you just give to the root CA, to the CA that you're sort of pointing at.
Right. We assume that VeriSign is unhackable, you know?
Right.
And this guy just proved that whoever the root CA was for them, I don't remember the name of it specifically who it was, but they are not unhackable.
Right.
So our next article comes from IT World. And we had talked before, you know, whenever we talk about net neutrality, about how some ISPs want to cap us and charge us per bit. Well, AT&T is starting to do that. We talked about this last week, I believe, for their DSL and UVerse customers. They're going to charge, you know, overage fees by the bit. And this article points out that AT&T might not be measuring those bits exactly correctly. As one person pointed out, his measurement was off by 4,700%. So I, for one, am glad I don't have AT&T internet service because they're not going to be doing this to me. But if this happens on a wider scale, this kind of blows a hole through the argument of the people who are on board with pay by the bit, you know, because how are companies measuring this? Where is the measurement taking place? On the the client computer, at the ISP, further on down the backbone. You know, what do you think about the pay by the bit?
Well, you know, in some ways, pay by the bit is fair. You know, it's like, well, it's just like water. You know, there's really, we talk about water not being a renewable resource, but typically in the context of like tap water, it's basically, you know, infinite in the sense that most local communities don't have to worry about running out of water, especially if they're near, you know, good aquifers. It's different if you live in the desert or something else, but if you use that analogy where you just pay per gallon, it seems like it's fair to pay per byte or bit, whatever it may be. I think there is an argument that, oh, well, really, if you use more of this resource, there's really no detriment to the seller of the bits.
Right.
But at some point, even with DSL, the connections become multiplexed in the sense that there's a backbone connection from a DSLAM or some kind of, which is a DSLAM is a DSL access module.
Yeah, the subscriber line access multiplexer.
Multiplexer. And basically what that does is take all of the, phone lines and multiplex it into some kind of backbone internet connection that then, you know, goes up to the internet from your local central office.
Yeah, people might not realize that. We have individual cables from the phone building to our house, mm-hmm. but once they get to that phone building, they all get multiplexed or joined into one right. so that it can go across the internet.
Yeah, and there's some guarantee of bandwidth, but not a full guarantee of bandwidth. So you're really sharing that resource with whoever's on your DSLAM. It is different from cable in the sense where cable is a shared medium. There's only so much bandwidth available on a given set of coax up into the point of the, I think they call it like the head end or something like that.
Yeah, whatever it's called.
So basically wherever the point is that then it turns into fiber and that gets sent to some other area. So anyway, it's less of a shared medium in the local area sense, but it's still shared once you get up to that backbone. As is any internet connection.
Right. Everything has to go across the backbone somewhere.
So, you know, basically, I think really what it boils down to is that I think paper bit is fair, but if they're going to do this, it has to be really accurate. And a misbilling of 4,700% and really negative 4,700%, I'd say, is unfair for everyone because... if they underbill somebody by a ridiculous amount, they're probably overbilling everyone else by a little bit. And that's unfair to them, especially if they're paying per bit.
Yeah, and you brought up the point about the DSLAM, the part where, you know, an entire town gets multiplexed into one cable to go across the backbone. And that's actually what they think happened here with AT&T's measurements with the 4,700% overage is that they were measuring the bits coming through the DSLAM, which is, you know, the entire town, mm-hmm. and pinning it on one person. But still, they need to not pull an AT&T here like AT&T did with the iPhone. So if you ever pay attention to anybody whenever you're traveling across countries, you're traveling overseas, you want to watch your data usage because data is extremely expensive when you're roaming. But on the iPhone, you have a data counter. It's in one of the preferences menus, shows you everything you're using. AT&T, however, says, no, that's not right. You can't trust that. If you want to watch your data usage, you need to download our app where we count your data usage. So, you know, you kind of have two different places to watch your data usage. And this is something that AT&T now has to watch on landline services, in that, you know, are they measuring it with an application you install on your machine? Are they measuring it at the DSLAM or the local building that it comes to? Or are they measuring it at the backbone level once it actually gets to an AT&T backbone? And if they do it at the DSLAM or the backbone, how are they splitting it apart to know what traffic is yours?
Yeah.
So they have a lot of problems to work through before they can actually do this. And they have suspended it. So they're not charging people like this anymore until they figure out how to do it correctly, which is good. So moving on, we have a story from Ars Technica again. We have a lot of Ars stories. Ars is a good site. If you haven't checked out Ars, you need to check out Ars. Yeah. Should we talk about that? Do you want to talk about that real quick?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think Ars is a really respected news site. At least it has been in the last, whatever it is, 1.2 × 10⁻²⁷ I don't know.
Whatever.
Basically, like 12 years. You know, I've gone to them for a lot of my tech news. And, you know, I've noticed recently that they've upped their, you know, frequency of posts. Their stories are more frequent and they're less technical. And recently there was a story that just sort of irked me because it really got a lot of things wrong with regards to data bus speeds related to, you know, backup technologies. You know, basically SATA versus USB versus FireWire.
Yeah, so the article was basically going over your different choices for backing up your files.
Yeah, and it talked about some solutions for the actual backup and then also for the medium or the interface over which you would back it up, like USB or SATA. And there were just some pretty misleading numbers in there. And, I emailed Ars Technica, and they did respond and correct the article, but it seems to me that they should be careful. You know, there's a lot of really, I mean, people really did in passive respected Ars Technica. And
yeah, especially when you're freaking Ars Technica.
Yeah.
Like you have this reputation and now you're kind of a fire hose. You yeah. know, you're just putting out stories and they're not quite as good as they used to be.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about guys that used to break down the latest processor technology and go into why a certain type of pipelining architecture was better than another, stuff that's like really, really down in the weeds. And I think really good because, you know, there's an interest in the community for that.
Yeah, they wouldn't be around. They wouldn't, you know, be selling ads to their advertisers, you know, if they weren't a good site that a lot of people visited.
Right. And by no means, I think Ars Technica is still a great site, but just be careful.
Now you kind of have to watch.
Yeah, I'd say, you know, until I don't see that again, which is hard to prove a negative, but
right.
You know, I'm going to be a little skeptical of things I read.
Yeah, so this article from Ars actually talks about Google teaming up with researchers at Georgia Tech. So Google was giving them $1 million so that they can develop some tools to detect internet throttling. So Google is obviously on the net neutrality bandwagon. They don't want people throttling. They don't want people messing with bits. And some people at Georgia Tech are also on that bandwagon, and they will now be developing some software that you can run on your own machine whenever it gets released, and it will determine whether or not your internet browsing, you know, all of your data on your machine that hits the internet, is being slowed down in any sort of way. So I don't know what their, you know, what the end point, do you know what they're going for with this? Like whether they want to use these in court cases or get people to sue their ISPs?
I really think this is a response to what happened, you know, in the Mideast and Northern Africa. We will now have a way, or hopefully we'll have a way, to detect this right away so there's no question of what's happening rather than relying on reports from people who may be biased or whatnot.
Right, right. Yeah, this is very interesting, though. I'm glad that Google is stepping up, giving money, and, you know, people at Georgia Tech are going to be writing the tools. I, you know, as soon as they're released, I'm going to go download them and see, because, you know, I don't know if my connection is throttled. I don't think it is. I get pretty decent speeds at home, but maybe it is. I don't know how they're detecting it, but that would be interesting if they release white papers, you know, on how they detect throttling. That I would be more interested than the tools themselves to know how they're detecting this stuff. So we have another article about some web browsers.
Yeah. So as everybody knows, you know, last week or maybe the week before, Internet Explorer released. Microsoft released version 9 of their Internet Explorer browser, and now Mozilla has released version 4, which is a pretty big milestone for them, of Firefox. And an article from Tech News World discusses that, you know, there's a lot of new features in Firefox, mainly related to, I don't know, there's features and there's also like streamlining, like simplifying their interface. But you know, there's also the thought that maybe they've lost some of their charm, that it's a less, you know, techie type browser, that they're, you know, they've embrace the minimalist style that both, you know, I think that Chrome pioneered, and that Microsoft followed suit with, and which Safari still has to embrace yet, I think. Safari hasn't...
Well, Safari has always been as minimalist as Chrome. There's only been like two quote-unquote bars at the top of the screen, and they're very small. So Safari has always been a small chromed browser.
I guess that's because in Mac OS, you always have your file menu across the top.
Right. That's not a part of the window.
Right. So maybe it's not quite a fair comparison, because on Windows, you know, Safari does have the file menu.
Right. So, that's the topmost bar of the browser.
Yeah. So it's a little different, I guess, in comparison to Mac OS. But I don't know. What do you think? I mean, I know you're a big Firefox user. Do you think it's a great upgrade, a good upgrade, or indifferent?
So I just downloaded Firefox the end of last week, Firefox 4, because I was worried that some of my extensions that I use every day wouldn't work. But I checked them all, and that's always the biggest thing for me when upgrading major releases of browsers. You know, I use extensions such as, you know, Adblocker, Delicious Bookmarks, some web developer extensions, things that I use on a daily basis that, sure, I can live without, and I have before, but I really, really don't want to. So I determined that, you know, most of my extensions would work, all but one, so I upgraded. And I noticed at first it looked exactly like Chrome. The tabs were on top. It was very minimal. I didn't like that, so I fixed it. I put the tabs back on bottom, and I made it look like Firefox again. So I like it so far. The only noticeable difference for me is whenever you do, you know, control tabs or switch tabs, they now give you a very Windows 7-esque switcher.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing that I hate, absolutely hate, I don't hate it because it's not there. I assume that with Firefox 4, they would have added the one process per tab deal like Chrome does.
Oh, they have
not. They have not. Because I had a tab freeze up on me because of a plugin, had to kill the whole browser.
Yeah.
And I thought that was one of the things of Firefox 4. Why can't I kill a tab?
Yeah.
Can't do it.
That's interesting, because it's something that I found that with as more and more as web pages have gotten more complex, that's a much better feature, because I do tend to run a bunch of tabs in one window.
Oh, I always have, you know, 10 tabs open, and some of them have Flash plugins. That's always the one that crashes on me. And, you know, now when it does, I still have to kill the whole browser, whereas I should just be able to kill a single tab. But yeah. Other than that, I've always been a Firefox user. I'm going to continue to use Firefox 4. I have no major qualms with it. It doesn't look like a big upgrade to me. You know, I don't see what's different about it.
Yeah, see, I expected a huge change. I mean, I know they definitely have changed the interface, you know, or the default settings for the interface.
Yeah, but you can put them back, which is what I did.
Right.
You know?
The funny thing is like Chrome is, you know, on version 9 now or 10, and it's really the same thing that was released. You know, they haven't, in terms of the interface, it's really just been like incremental features that they've added.
It's bug patches and...
Well, I wouldn't say... I mean, I think most of it's functionality release, you know, they've added. They probably have fixed bugs
But my point is that it's not like a major interface UI change or anything.
No, it hasn't been an architectural... I mean, it was one process per tab from the start, minimalistic, you know, design from the start. So it'll be interesting maybe if there's a second generation to Chrome, but...
Yeah, I wonder, you know, we talked about a story before where Chrome was increasing their output. They were going to do like four major versions a year or something. Have we heard anything about them as to when the next overhaul version would be?
I haven't, and that's an interesting point, you know, because their versions definitely do not equal mainstream versions. I mean, for them to release a browser, let's remember that I think Chrome is really only about 2 years old.
Yeah, and they're already to version 9 or 10.
Yeah.
Compare that with Internet Explorer 1 and Internet Explorer 9, huge difference. Chrome, no difference.
Yeah.
You know?
Very, very little, yeah.
Very interesting. So even though I don't care about Chrome at all, I don't use it, I don't plan to use it in the future, I'm interested to see when they're going to make a big change. So our next article comes from law.com. This is by far... freaking ridiculous. I don't know how else to say this. So, in Manhattan, there is a case about people downloading files via LimeWire. And the music studios are asking for $75 trillion. You can't see this, but my pinky is in my mouth. $75 trillion.
Having visions of Dr. Evil.
Yeah, $75 trillion doesn't even exist. Like, that's more than the GDP of the entire planet. And
I hadn't thought about it that way. I know the GDP for the United States is like 14 trillion or something.
Yeah, 75 is more money than the whole planet makes.
Yeah.
And the music studios are asking for $75 trillion. And basically, Judge Kimba Wood said, ha! No. He just basically said, no. Not going to happen. Absurd?
Oh, very absurd. I mean, super absurd. There's, I think, you know, a lot of this goes back to when they criminalized copyright infringement with respect to, you know, movies and music.
Yeah, and you explained a little bit about this last week.
Yeah, and they added these really hefty fines that I think are just unfounded, you know.
And here's the thing about those fines. So the article from law.com points out that the music labels were saying, well, Section 504C, paragraph 1 of the Copyright Act provided for damages for each instance of infringement where two or more parties were liable. So I went to the Copyright Act, and that's the next article on the list.
Hey, Kevin, your monocle's got something on it.
Oh, hold on. I need to clean my monocle. And I scrolled down to Section 504, C, paragraph 1. Here is what the law says in regards to, you know, music companies getting their money's worth. So anytime before final judgment, the plaintiff can elect to not take real damages. They can take statutory damages. And statutory damages are arbitrary, you know, for any of you who know that. It's basically the law makes up a number, and that's the number they go with. Doesn't mean anything. But here's what the law says in this case. A sum of not less than $500 or more than $20,000 as the court considers just. So the music labels were like, huh, for every work, we get $20,000. So this is where they were starting to get their 75 trillion number because of the amount of songs that were proven to be shared. But if you read paragraph 2, this goes on a little more. In a case where the copyright owner, so the music labels, have the burden of proving that their stuff was stolen, which is what they were going for because they determined people were stealing their music, so they had the burden of proving it, then the statutory damages are a sum of not more than $100,000. So this is their number. The music labels were trying to get $100,000 per copyrighted act, and the judge is like, yeah, this was written before all of this stuff happened. You're not getting this.
Yeah.
I mean, so this is another one of those cases. You know, we talked about the DMCA and how it needs to be either rewritten or removed. The Copyright Act is another one. You know, these numbers and the wording of it to give people these numbers is just utterly ridiculous.
Yeah, I understand that there's, you know, some possible damages, but there should never be more damages than the company is even worth. You know, like, it's just...
Well, I mean, why do you have these damages in the first place? It's because you don't want to have the copyright owners not make material anymore. You know, if they're getting their stuff stolen, mm-hmm. you don't want them to say, okay, I'm not making music anymore. People are stealing my stuff. You know, that's why these laws are here. But look at it from the other side. Has anybody stopped making music? No. If anything, artists are coming to their senses and releasing things on the internet. You know, a lot of artists are going without a label and releasing things themselves. You have bands like Radiohead and Nine Inch Nails using the pay-as-you-want model or the pay, you know, $5, a very low sum for the digital version. So, I mean, these laws, what they were put into place to protect isn't a problem. No artist is not making music anymore.
Right. Well, there's some interesting things about the music industry that came to light early on in the whole timeline of this, like, you know, copyright infringement and Napster and MP3s and everything else. And part of that was that a lot of the big box retailers just started to carry less carried much less of the of CDs, you know, music, DVDs. They didn't carry as much. And I think if anyone would realize in the last 10 years, it's much harder to find a CD or a DVD you want locally. If Walmart or Best Buy doesn't have it, good luck.
You're going to the internet.
Yeah, you're going to go to the internet and find it. And as retailers carried less and less of the product, that's how their sales develop. Like, that's how the studios distribution channels realize their sales are through what they sell to big box retailers. At least at that time it was. And I think that's why they saw a somewhat of a decline in profit. This number is just outrageous. I mean, if you think about it, $75 trillion, I think the most you should ever be able to claim on losses is the price of the retail price of it. So that means that in order for them to claim $75 trillion, there would have to have been 99 cents a track, $75 trillion in instances of infringement for this one person. Right. And I just think that's impossible. That number is so large that it's just, you know, that it would outstrip all sales of music ever.
Yeah, basically statutory damages are great for the people who get them, but they mean, you know, crap for the people who have to pay them. They're not real. They shouldn't be able to be collected.
Not at those levels.
Right. So our next article talks about search warrants for hard drives.
Yeah. So there's some interesting, Fourth Amendment rights advocate discussions and new laws about hard drives and how the limits that need or that aren't there and may need to be placed on searching of someone's hard drive. So, and a lot of it comes down to, you know, existing law on searching property. Obviously, if the police get a search warrant to your house for something, they're allowed to search the premises for the things they're looking for, but they're only allowed to do so for a certain period of time. And I'm not exactly sure what those restrictions are, but they can't search endlessly. An interesting thing about, you know, digital media is, you know, a copy could be made of it, and it could be searched endlessly.
And that's what most, you know, forensics people do. You know, when they come in and take your hard drive from a crime scene, they will instantly make a copy of it, and then, yes, they have that forever.
Yeah. So there's some interesting cases out there right now and some precedent that has yet to be set about how much time should be given to, you know, to someone to search a hard drive. In some instances, you could say, well, if you didn't do anything wrong, they should be able to search endlessly.
Because they would never find anything.
Right. But there's also the thought that it's pretty easy to commit a crime and not even know it, in today's world. There's so much criminalization that has gone on. And I don't say this, lightly. There really has been a massive expansion of criminal law in the last 50 years, and more so even in the last probably like 10 to 20 years, that there are things that you would never think would be illegal that could possibly find yourself imprisoned because of it. And things you may have done unknowingly. And just because you didn't have the foresight or knowledge to hire a lawyer, that you could easily be put away for this. So I think it's an interesting concept, like how long should they be allowed to search? What parts of the hard drive should they be allowed to search?
Should they be able to force you to give them your encryption password to decrypt your hard drive?
Yeah, I think like as it stands that, you know, from what I've read that they can ask you for it, but you are in no way obligated to give up a password or an encryption key to a hard drive or digital media.
Yeah, that's actually what people recommend whenever you are traveling overseas, because a lot of times they will take your laptops and turn them on and try to look for stuff to make sure you're not a terrorist, but they can't force you to give them your encryption password if your whole hard drive is encrypted.
Right. And I watched a video recently on YouTube about it was actually like I'm not sure which university it was, but it was a law class, and they had a police officer, I think a detective actually, a police detective from a local police department, and a criminal defense lawyer. And both of them argued that you should, if you're being investigated for a crime, regardless of your what you're believed,
regardless of what you're quote unquote booked for,
well, what you're booked for and what you believe your guiltiness to be, like even if you think 100% without a doubt you're completely innocent of what they accused you of, your best option is to not cooperate with the police. Like, do not tell them anything, like nothing. And the reason isn't that, you know, oh, well, maybe you did do something wrong. It's that if you just happen to trip up in a lie, not even a lie, just if you trip up in what you said, you make a statement and you genuinely forget what statement you made and say something to the contrary or slightly different, they can use it in a court of law to prove that you're a liar, basically.
To disprove or not disprove, you discredit you.
Yeah, and once they discredit you, the jury loses all faith. You know, their advice is just do not talk to the police. And it's sad that it's that way. Like, it really is that you have to almost be fearful when cooperating with law enforcement, you know, for your own defense and whatnot. But yeah,
the first thing out of your mouth should be, get me a lawyer.
Yeah.
And then nothing else should come out of your mouth until that lawyer is there.
Right. And this article, I think, is a pretty good example of, like, how I think law enforcement has in some ways been misused. And I would say that the size of our prison system is a perfect example of that. You know, that
everybody's in jail.
Yeah. We have the most people in jail of any industrialized country. And I'm not trying to be an activist about this, but I think there's actual physical evidence that the criminalization of society is provable or it's demonstrative based on the way things actually are. You know, if we had the least amount imprisoned in the world, then I would have no place in saying this, you know, but it's the complete opposite.
It's the opposite.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. I'd hate to bring up TV shows, you know, where they show, you know, lawyers discrediting people and, you know, finding things on their hard drives and stuff, because, you know, those TV shows aren't always 100% accurate. But it's sad to say that they do actually give you some insight into how things actually work. You know, even though it seems like, oh, that wouldn't really happen in real life. No, that's really how they discredit people in real life. They'll catch you up. You might have said, oh, on Thursday, no, I was, you know, visiting the MLB, Major League Baseball website. And they ask you 2 weeks later in a deposition or something, and you say, oh, I was browsing the NFL website. Bam, they use that against you. You are done.
Yep.
Like something stupid as what website you were looking at. And that's what they do. So, yes, I agree with you. I have no further thoughts because you did a great job of explaining that. So going along with law, except this time in China. So I want to bring up a movie quote here. Ryan, you can't say bomb on an airplane.
I guess you can't.
Bomb, 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 bomb.
What's that from?
Meet the Parents.
Oh.
So apparently, if you are in China, you can't say protest on a phone. Because if you do, your phone disconnects. And they actually tested this out. They said it in English, phone call disconnected. The dude called back, said it in Mandarin, phone call disconnected. If you literally say the word protest on a phone in China, your call will be disconnected.
Interesting.
I mean, this goes along very well with...
What if it was like, I said, Kevin, Apple sucks, and you're like, I protest.
Exactly. Done. Yeah, because they weren't even... The reason this happened in the first place is because he was quoting Shakespeare to the person he was talking to, and he said, the lady doth protest too much. And as soon as he said the word protest...
Taming the Shrew, I think?
I have no clue.
I think it is.
But as soon as he said that, bam, phone call, hang up. So he called back, you know, again, and this time tried it in Mandarin, and it did the same thing. And that's how they determined, whenever you say the word protest, China will hang up the phone for you. And this goes right along with the Great Firewall of China. You know, we all know they block data. They block Google search results to certain things. They block websites that they don't feel is good for their people. And now they're doing it on phone calls, too.
And they don't like Hamlet. It was from Hamlet.
Oh, it was Hamlet. Yeah. What have they got against Hamlet?
I don't know.
I mean, come on, Shakespeare. Shakespeare was great. Do you have any extra thoughts on this? You know,
no. I mean, if they're really afraid of people just saying the word protest, then I think they've got bigger problems.
Well, I mean, you know, they have their great firewall. They've already proven they have bigger problems because they're trying to control the internet. But yeah, it's pretty ridiculous. So for any of you, if you do foreign travel, test this out. You know, whenever you go, I mean, maybe I shouldn't say that because you might get arrested. I don't know. Maybe it's more than just your phone call hanging up. So don't do that unless you're willing to get thrown into Chinese prison.
Maybe you know, there's things that that we have that we can't say and we just don't know it. And those are what our dropped calls are all from.
Well,
we're just like,
it's not AT&T.
Yeah, we're just like, we're just saying the wrong things, or the protest detection software is malfunctioning.
Well, I was going to say, we all know about, you know, the NSA data centers where all internet and phone traffic run through, and you know, they catch what was the name of that sharks, the name of the software that did this. It was like Tyrannosaurus Rex or something. I don't know. It was really cool software. And, you know, it triggers on key phrases and starts recording if it hears people say that. So we do have something like that. It doesn't cut off your phone call, but we have a similar thing.
Interesting.
Yeah, you should look it up. This is bothering me that I forget the name of the software. It's something mean sounding, like a dinosaur or something. Sound like you had something to say there.
Like thesaurus?
Like thesaurus. That was a lame Twitter joke that I made a week ago. I just want to know, talking about dinosaurs, when the thesaurus became a book. So our next article comes from iSpice.com, and it's pretty interesting. So we all know that Facebook has an age limit, or a minimum age to entry, I guess we should say. You have to be 13 or older to be on Facebook. But this article points out that every day, Facebook bans 20,000 underage users, people who are under 13 accessing Facebook. So here's, you know, as soon as I said this to my sister, she was like, why don't they just put in that they're older?
Yeah.
And yeah, that would work.
Well, but really young kids who are just like, don't really understand the concept of lying yet.
Exactly. Yeah. If you try to sign up for an account and you're under 13, you know, they will ban you. Like, I don't know what the length of this ban is, whether they're banning email addresses or IP addresses. Like, I don't know how they ban, but they ban 20,000 people a day for trying to sign up as under 13. So this brings up the one question that I wanted to ask you about this. If you had kids who were under 13, would you let them use Facebook?
You know, I read this article and I started to think about, you know, I don't really see the harm in using Facebook, but I don't see the harm in using anything as long as it's supervised. So if there's parental supervision and obviously some kind of parental control put in place, then I don't see any harm in it. That's really where I stand on it.
Yeah,
you know,
I feel the same way.
Anything.
Yeah, I feel the same way, you know, and especially since Facebook does have, you know, ridiculous privacy settings that you can jack up so they can't see other people. People can't see them. People can't search for them. You know, it's only friends.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they can change that, but then enters in the parental supervision part. You know, you need to be watching your young kids when they're using the internet, as you should, whether it's Facebook or not. If they're just using the computer, you should be, you know, watching every once in a while, make sure what they're doing.
Yeah, and there's software out there that
yeah, there's NetNanny. And,
yeah.
And I mean, smarter people will, you know, block sites on their router so that, because if you have software like NetNanny installed on the computer, kids can just, you know, Google for how to disable NetNanny and figure it out. Whereas if you do it on your router, they don't have the password to the router. They're not getting to the bad sites.
Right.
But I'm definitely with you. You know, when I have kids in the future, however long in the future that may come.
Next year.
What? If you say that and that becomes true, Ryan's
I'm
a prophet.
I'm like the oracle, dude.
You are the oracle. Not the database people. The predictor of all things. But, I mean, I just got an iPad. Yeah! I got my iPad today. Hold on, I have something for this. I have an iPad.
Okay. It's pretty lame. I saw it.
Yeah, Ryan played with it. I like it.
It has some powerful magnets, though.
Oh, dude, the magnets. The videos that you saw on the internet of people holding up their iPad via the cover are true. I did it. I don't think I'm going to try it anymore in the future because I'm deathly afraid that it's going to fall, but it does work.
I'm using it now. Can you hear?
Oh, I can't hear. I turned off keyboard clicks and stuff because I hate those. But my point in that being, you know, I have these mobile devices with access to the internet, and when I have kids, I'm not going to have any problem letting them use it. You know, of course I'm going to supervise, but they're going to be able to play with my iPad and, you know, browse the internet. No problem. So, I think that's all I have to say about that.
Yeah.
Let's move into our next section. We have a bunch of mobile stories. Our first story was very interesting to me because, as we all know, Google, when they originally made their Android operating system, which runs, you know, all of their mobile phones, I always argue with people when they say, oh, I got a Droid. Did you really get a Droid? Did you get a Motorola Droid? Or did you just get an Android phone and you like to call everything Droid because you're dumb? So I argue with people about that. But the whole point of that was to have an open source phone operating system. Well, now with Honeycomb, Google is keeping a hold on their code. Not open source. What do you think about this?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. You know, Google's in a weird position. They need to sort of like, they have market share that they need to protect. And they have part of that is protecting the quality of their product. And so I think I could see why there's an interest in sort of like, you know, at least walling off certain sections of their software. But it does scare me that if they do that, they may just open themselves up for like sort of an attack in the sense that someone else is going to say, fine, here's our really truly open source system. They mentioned like Mego, and that may take over.
Yeah, I kind of see Android as Linux. You know, Android, I think of it as a kernel, as Linux is a kernel, and you have Red Hat and Fedora and Ubuntu and all of these distributions. That's kind of what we're seeing with Android now. We're seeing the fragmentation of Android where Motorola puts their skin and their software on it, and HTC does their thing. So there's actually really distributions of Android out there right now. But I'm wondering what's going to happen with Honeycomb. You know, Honeycomb is their tablet-designed Android operating system. Now that the code's not out there anymore, you know, this I actually see this as a security risk, because that's always the one benefit I give people of open-source software, is that you have millions, if not millions, thousands, hundreds of people looking at the code. Hundreds of people can pick up flaws more than the two lead developers who write the product. Mm-hmm. So I always give that as a security benefit to open source software, in that everybody can look at it and everybody has an opinion and can fix it. And now I'm wondering if, since Honeycomb is not going to be open sourced, at least at this point, if we're going to start seeing more people attack it, or more people or more public attackings, maybe. Do you get where I'm going with this?
Mm-hmm.
So that's, we have a couple Google stories. So, I think this is one step them heading in the wrong direction. But our next story, I also think, is a step in the wrong direction. And this article is from BNet, the CBS Interactive Business Network, basically CBS News. And
BNet.
Yeah, BNet.com.
To be or not to be.
Ooh, more Shakespeare.
Yeah. That'd be a great slogan for them. To be net or not to be net.
Ooh. You should call them right now.
I should.
Do a who is on their domain name, find the contact phone number. So anyways, Google submitted a patent for mobile payments. Now, you might think, oh, you know, this is kind of cool because Google does some NFC stuff, near field communications. You know, maybe they're trying to, you know, just make payments better and easier from cell phones and other things. But no, that's not at all what they're doing. If you scroll down in the article, you'll see a diagram from the patent application. Google is trying to become a middleman. It seems like they're trying to skim money off the top, Whereas right now, if I want to buy something from Amazon, I go, hey, Amazon, let me buy this. And Amazon goes, hey, give me your money. I say, okay, and I get the product. It's a straight one-to-one customer-to-merchant deal.
Well, sort of. I mean, if Amazon actually sells the product, that's true.
Yeah, I'm not talking about third-party sellers. I'm talking about something that comes straight from Amazon.
Yeah, but I mean, they have a lot of third-party sellers.
They do have a lot.
You could almost say that Amazon in and of itself is its own internet.
It really is.
I mean, it has, like, you know, if you want to find out about a product, it has information, like, in the comments. And I'm not, it's really not its own internet. But the point is, you get my point.
Yeah. The point is that I get your point.
The point is that you get my point. That is the point. The point is...
to be or not to be. But so let me make up a better example. If I'm buying something from Sony, you can buy stuff direct from Sony on their website.
Yeah.
So customer to merchant straight through. Google is trying to come into this to be a broker, to be the middleman, where I say, hey, I want this Sony TV. And Google's like, okay, here's the TV Sony has. Give me your money. I give Google my money. Google transfers that money to Sony, cutting some off the top, which actually I was just overcharged so that Google can cut some off the top. But what do you think about Google trying to be this whole middleman deal?
Well, I don't see any problem with someone being a middleman. basically, there may be a service that they provide that warrants that skimming. You know, that they, like Amazon, collects all this stuff into like a searchable, organized, you know, database of products with a taxonomy applied to it, with comments, user ratings.
Right. So for those third party resellers, you know, they are a middleman. Amazon is a middleman.
Yeah. And even for Sony, because they sell Sony products on their website. You know what I mean? So really for any manufacturer, Amazon is a middleman, just like any retail outlet really is a middleman. But they're there because they provide you, you know, maybe someone else has done the research as to like what are the best products to buy out there, like what's the best value.
There's some sort of curation.
Right. Like, exactly. Good word, curation. Here's the thing. I don't think that modern companies do a good job of curation. I think they do a terrible job of curation, and I think Google's one of the worst at it. I hate to say, I like a lot of Google's product, but their curation abilities are awful. Like, yeah, you can go on Google and you can search for a product and find it at the cheapest place. Fine. But I think you can do that a lot of other ways too. You know, you can just, it's always a couple of the top sellers, and the ones that aren't the top sellers are not typically highly rated. You wouldn't buy from them anyways.
Right. You might be able to buy from the cheapest place, but that cheapest place might also steal money from you.
Right. Here's an example. I run sound for a band, and I had been trying to buy a set of speaker support poles for the speakers for the sound system we have. And, you know, this particular model pole was not available from the typical retailers that I usually would buy this from. And I wondered why. But Google search would still return results in their products or their shopping category from these websites that were somewhat suspect in my mind. And they would say that they had them, but then a handful of them, you'd go to their website and they would say, oh, we're out of stock. But for some reason, Google Shopping didn't pick that up like they did with the other sites. And the ones that did say they had them in stock were like really fishy. So I just think that for the average, yeah, I'm able to discern that. But we're talking about making computers usable for those that can't discern that, which is a lot of what, you know, Apple has been really good at. And I think that this is something that Google is failing miserably at. They will continue to fail miserably at if they don't totally change the way they do. Like, there's some things that crowdsourcing is good for, and maybe they're just applying the wrong weighting to the information they're getting. But in some cases, I think it's you're getting really bad results. So them being a middleman, in my opinion, does not warrant them making any money if this is the product that I'm getting in the end.
Yeah, and what about these other privacy concerns in that, you know, whenever you make a payment to somebody, that merchant gets a lot of your information, credit card number, you know, name, address, phone number, anything that's associated with your credit card. Normally, Google would not get that information in any sense of the term. if you just did a Google search to find a product and then you went to a merchant's page and bought something. But now that they're going to be this middleman, you know, we already know Google likes to collect information.
That's true, but there are laws against using that information for direct-to-consumer marketing. Like, there was an article recently about a man that, you know, he's I'm trying to think of how it works. Like, you know how they ask you for your zip code sometimes?
Right.
When you buy something? You do not have to give them your zip code.
Like, you're in the store.
Right.
And you purchase something at a counter, and they're like, yes. Oh, what's your phone number?
Right.
What's your zip code?
It's completely unlawful for them to ask you, let alone use it, for direct-to-consumer marketing.
And that's exactly what they use it for.
Yeah. Well, as far as I know, sometimes they say that it's to benefit your security.
I actually had somebody at the last purchase I made, they asked me that, and I'm like, no. And they're like, oh, it's just for, you know, giving you special offers and deals. And I'm like, no, you're still not getting it.
Right.
Yeah, I agree with you. I need to see what service Google is offering other than just being the middleman, because maybe they're going to make something super easy. However, we've seen in the past, you know, Apple makes things easy, like you said. Google makes things work and work well, but they're not necessarily easy. So this is going to be a big step for Google if they plan on, you know, they were talking about companies like PayPal and eBay. So if they're going to insert themselves into companies like that that everybody uses, they better have some value add to the situation. So our next article, still talking about Google, and back to Android this time. So the Motorola Droid, the Droid 2, the Droid X, all of Motorola's smartphones run Android.
Yeah, immensely successful phones, I would add, and huge catalysts for the, you know, the whole Android movement.
Right, and that is, you know, what I was talking about earlier with people who don't know what they're talking about. They just call everything Droid now because of Motorola. But Motorola is actually thinking about getting rid of Android and starting a new OS based on the ARM chip, the ARM processor. I think this would be absolutely horrible for Google and the Android market share if Motorola pulled out.
I do think it would be bad, but there's a lot of vendors that are still signed on. You know, I mean, HTC is still a huge portion of their business, and
I really think HTC is the only big one. You know, Samsung does have a couple, but HTC and Motorola, they were the heavy hitters of Android.
They are. They're definitely the big players in the Android, at least in the U.S. market. I think it's interesting, though, that they're announcing this sort of, well, I don't know if they've really made an announcement, but there's some rumors about this switch. And what I don't really understand is, like, they're saying that they're going to revive their ARM partnership. As far as I know, Motorola already uses a Texas Instruments processor, I thought, that's based on an ARM architecture.
Yeah, I don't know where they're going with this.
Yeah,
revive the partnership.
That's what I don't know, because, like, ARM is a processor technology, not an OS technology.
Right.
So I'm not certain, like, what that really means. But anyway, let's say they are going towards this web-based OS. I wonder if this is a an attack before the fact of, from what, like, they're assuming that Apple might do with their iOS, you know, that it might become more cloud web-based.
And that is exactly what the rumors are for iOS 5.
Right, right. So maybe Motorola knows something that the rest of the industry doesn't. And
so they want their own OS that competes with iOS.
Right. They don't see that. They don't see it moving that way with Android. So they're trying to preempt, is the word I was looking for. Preempt, you know, preemptive attack.
Well, here's my thoughts on that, though. You know, Android as it stands now, not Honeycomb, is open source. Why can't they just use Android and write their own services on top of it and put on their phones to make it cloud-based Android? You know, they could do that.
Well, those sort of things are always easier said than done. You know, there could be a lot of costs with that, you know. And for instance, here's a simple example. I don't know if this is really true, but a cloud-based OS would probably use a lot more of the radio, in a sense it would have to keep a connection active a lot more. So they would have to be really worried about power consumption of the actual processor itself if they're going to trade that for radio time, and they need something really stripped down and streamlined, and maybe Android just can't provide that.
And we all know the battery life of a lot of Android phones is absolute crap.
Yeah. What, regardless of like what the cause is,
right,
it is bad. And maybe even if it were good, that they would still need some kind of stripped down OS,
right,
to support this good battery power.
Yeah, even if the battery was good, it might be crap once you make it cloud-based and always using the radio.
Yeah, you know, there's trade-offs that you have to make in design, and I'm sure there's some reason that they're looking into this.
Yeah, and it seems like that's the way it's going for the smartphone market, is more services pushed to the cloud. And what I want to know is, how are they protecting against, what was that, was it a Nokia phone or Microsoft phone, the Sidekick, that stored all of its contacts in the cloud, and
yeah,
when that server went down, everybody lost everything?
Yeah,
it a Nokia Sidekick? Or
no, it was the T-Mobile Sidekick.
T-Mobile.
And it, that was owned by Danger, but then Microsoft bought the whole Danger network, and then something happened to one of the servers.
The server went down.
Yeah, basically. And it was backed up, but not in a, like, on-demand way.
Yeah, they got their stuff back eventually.
Right, but it took out their contacts if they synced to the server or something like that. Like,
I believe there was an option that they could have kept a copy on their SIM, not their SIM card, their SD card.
Yeah.
But you would have had to go in and turn that on.
Yeah.
But either way, yeah. You know, how are they going to prevent things like that from happening?
It's a challenge, definitely. I mean, cloud services have, you know, they have a lot of hurdles to overcome. But they're doable hurdles, I think.
Yeah, and one final point that I want to make on that is that it seems like whenever there's a hurdle that nobody, this is going to sound, you know, I'm going to sound like a total fanboy here, but it seems like whenever there are hurdles that nobody either can't get over, or they just haven't even thought of yet as being a hurdle, Apple will come through and do it. You know, kind of like they did when they first released the iPhone. Nobody even thought of a phone doing what the iPhone did, and Apple's like, hey, we never made a phone before, but check this out. Where I'm going with that is WWDC is coming up the first week of June, and they're going to be talking about iOS 5 and all of their new cloud, the push to the cloud. So I'm interesting to watch. You know, you can watch live whenever they broadcast it, all of the keynotes and everything. I'm interested to see what happens there, because this is just me going out on a limb here. I think Apple has already looked into this cloud thing, and they figured out a lot of stuff that everybody else has kind of been, you know, staying behind on because they don't quite know how to fix it yet. So I'll be interested to see the first week of June what Apple has to say about cloud services on phones. So our next article from Computer World. All of you who have smartphones have probably heard that there are applications out there like, you know, find out where cops are. So they use GPS as you're driving down the road. If you see a cop, a speed trap, you can open up the app, click a button, it tracks your GPS and plots it on a map so other people with the app can see, oh, there's a speed trap here, I should probably slow down. Well, there are also DUI checkpoint apps that do the same thing. And most of these apps do all of these things all in one. Phantom Alert is one of them, and it does many functions like this. Well, senators have, you know, the article says that senators have contacted Apple and said, you need to pull these. Well, they've also contacted, you know, Google and other smartphone manufacturers. Google's already said, no, we're not pulling these apps. So they also said the same thing to Apple. And I do not know what Apple's final decision was. Did you read any more after this article came out?
I haven't.
So it's basically just talk about the fact that the government is asking, you know, smartphone manufacturers to remove these applications. Sounded like you were going to keep going before I interrupted you.
Well, this reminds me, the argument for these applications reminds me of the argument for radar detectors. And for a long time, you know, you could buy radar detectors, even on like QVC and Home Shopping Network, you could buy them. And the argument they made was that by allowing the driver to focus on the road and just listen for an audible beep, that that was more time that it detracted from the time they spent from, you know, looking at their speedometer. So every time you glance down to your speedometer is a few milliseconds that you miss.
You're not paying attention.
Right, miss on the road, and that you know, you So, and there was a lot of, you know, like very like tentative arguments. They're, you know, like maybe, okay, maybe. And then of course they added in other features, like there's like safety warning system. So like, I guess when you like approach a construction zone, it would have, there's a radio transmitter that would, the radar detector would pick up and then say, hey, there's a construction zone. And I think the argument for these DUI apps is that when people who like to go out to the bars see that, oh, there's going to be a checkpoint out on this day or whatever, that they would just not go out that night. And that, of course, then prevents them from drinking, which prevents them from driving, drinking and driving, and should prevent accidents.
Yeah, so that's exactly the reason the article gave. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a tentative, I think it's, or I don't know if tentative is not the right word. It's hard to support the argument because, you know, you say, oh, these people would have committed a crime, but would have, should have, could have. I mean, would have is not committing a crime. And there's a lot of, you know, talk about, we talked before about how things are criminalized now. But, you know, yes, drinking and driving is wrong. You know, if you're over the legal limit and you're driving, that's wrong. You know, it's a crime. But if you do make it home and you didn't hurt anyone, what was there any harm to society? So there has to, and then every crime has this thing called a mens rea, meaning that you had malintent. And I don't think most drunk drivers actually have malintent, not to defend drinking and driving.
Right.
It's, you know, I think, you know, that really the intent is beforehand. But, you know, in some parts of our society, we totally accept this notion of, well, if you didn't want to get into that situation, you shouldn't have been drinking. But then other parts of our society don't accept this argument. And not to go totally political on everyone, but, you know, the abortion is one of those examples where, you know, we don't say to, we don't say that, oh, well, if you didn't want to get pregnant, you shouldn't have had unprotected sex, I guess. So that's one example of where our society misapplies those concepts, that one has the mens rea and one doesn't, or that we have an implied mens rea, I guess.
Right.
So, you know, these things are really touchy. And the way I look at it, I'm very libertarian on these things. If there was no harm to society done, then it's not a criminal act. You know, if no one's rights were infringed upon, you didn't violate any law. And I mean, that's that's really like a federal standpoint, from a very top level, and top down approach.
Yeah, it's a very perfectionist stamp. That's not the right word, but,
well,
what's the word I'm looking for there?
I guess really this, we're really just talking about, you know, people have a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's a very federal, it's a very top level, like, the, you know, the federal government level type thing. Your community can still make laws against whatever they want.
Right.
You know, and you just don't have to choose to live in that community. But nonetheless, these are very, I think, you know, these are on the razor's edge, like which way people fall. And it's hard to get a, it's hard to be objective about these things. Everybody has a position, and I hope I didn't try to like, I'm not trying to like deter anyone, or about the political views of myself or the show, but you know, just an example of like how some people could be in favor of it and some couldn't.
Yeah. I'm actually just going to take a stand on one side of the fence and say that the senator shouldn't be asking to remove these applications.
I
think they should be there.
Well, I mean, I don't think that it infringes upon any laws. So,
Right.
From that standpoint, yes.
Yes. You know, personal feelings aside, there is nothing wrong with these applications.
Right.
So I guess I'll just leave it at that. That's my opinion. So our next article, Ryan, is something you submitted about Verizon.
Yeah. Actually, I'm going to give a little credit back to Ars Technica because this is where I saw it. Interestingly enough, from the same author of the article that I had a little bit of displeasure
really?
With.
Really?
Yes, I actually noticed this after the fact.
The cute author.
Yeah. Kevin thinks she's cute. I don't know.
She is.
Anyway.
Very cute.
Basically, there's a article about the deployment of 4G technologies in the United States, and they link to a Verizon map. And the interesting thing about this for myself and Kevin and all the fellow Johnstowners.
I have no clue.
I like Johnstonians, but well, I'm not sure if that even works.
I think it would be Johnstownians.
Johnstownians. Who knows?
Yeah.
Anyway, if you live in Johnstown, it's good news that 4G should be here by the end of the year.
Now, let's be specific. We're not talking Sprint 4G, AT&T 4G, T-Mobile 4G. We're talking LTE.
Yeah, we're talking LTE. We're talking real full-on 4G from Verizon, the one who I saw today. There was an article rating some of the 4G services, and Verizon basically blows.
That's actually the follow-on article on the list.
Oh, okay, that's where I saw it. Sorry, not to ruin everyone's, ruin this element of surprise. But yeah, this is like full-on 4G in Johnstown. It's a planned city by the end of the year. They said third, fourth quarter.
Yeah, so if you go to the link that I have in the show notes there, that takes you to the Verizon 4G coverage map. So you can see every place that has it now. There is a tab on that map for coming soon. And they will show you all the towns that are planned to get 4G by the end of the year.
Yeah. So for Pennsylvania, they have Allentown, Bethlehem, Easton, like all one area, Erie, Harrisburg, Johnstown, Scranton, Wilkes-Barre, and State College.
Yeah, so that is very interesting in that, Pittsburgh already has it. I believe Reading already has it. Or Philadelphia.
Philadelphia,
sorry.
But I think Reading might fall into that because it's not too far
away.
Yeah,
so right now, two cities pretty much have it. Johnstown and Erie are really the only two cities that are not around, at least close
probably,
enough.
And also Harrisburg.
They don't have it either. Harrisburg's kind of out there. So yeah, there are three cities that aren't around either Pittsburgh or Philly.
What'll be interesting is whether or not this Johnstown market includes Altoona. Because Altoona is a neighboring city that's about the same size, maybe slightly larger than Johnstown, that's sort of halfway between us and State College.
Yeah, it's like Altoona is to State College as Johnstown is to Pittsburgh. They're kind of similar.
Something
Altoona's
like that.
A little closer to State College than we are to Pittsburgh, but
yeah.
It's very similar.
Yeah, and I think the size differential isn't quite as large. But yeah, it's another fairly sizable population center.
Yeah, and this is just my opinion, but I think it will include Altoona just because, in anything that happens, they always get grouped together.
Yeah,
it's always the Altoona-Johnstown region.
Yeah, it typically is, yeah.
So why this is cool? Now, of course, it's 4G. Holy crap. It's going to be cool. But the next article is they show some graphs of some tests that they ran on all the quote-unquote 4G services. So we're counting, HSPA+, WiMAX, all the things that aren't really 4G, and then LTE, which Verizon is the only one right now that offers that. And if you look at the first graph, the average data speeds, you will see the reason why we always talk about LTE on this show and how we can't wait for it. AT&T, their 4G HSPA+, total crap. Sprint and T-Mobile, also total crap, but equal. They get about 4.25, megabits downstream. Verizon on LTE, over 17 megabits downstream.
Yeah.
I mean, the graph is just so skewed to Verizon. Verizon's upload speed is faster than everybody else's download speed.
Combined, almost. Almost. Yeah. Not quite, but almost.
I mean, this is why we're excited about LTE, because it really is a 4G next generation technology.
Yeah, they also have another graph. It's data download speed intervals, and I think this is like the percent of like connections at that speed, and in the greater than 10 megabit category, Verizon is like the total domination,
like 89%.
Yeah, and I mean it's pretty impressive, I have to say.
Yeah, and this just goes to show that LTE is the bandwagon.
Yeah.
So all of these other places with not quite 4G, we know that AT&T is implementing LTE. They're doing it slower, so it's not going to be out anytime soon. But, Verizon right now has LTE in certain cities. A lot more will have it by the end of the year. And I'm just going to go out and say, whenever the iPhone 5 comes out, if it has an LTE chip in it, I am switching to Verizon. Not even going to think about it.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that makes me kind of like a little bit, it makes me feel a little bit better is like I have no problem paying the slight, 10 or 15% price premium that Verizon commands if they're actually going to reinvest this money in their network. And it seems like they are. It really does. You know, truth, we'll see the truth as their 4G network rolls out. But this the previous article, you know, that's linked to the website from Verizon, they claim that they're going to roll out 4G to like 95 or 97% of the American public by 2013.
Yeah, it's a crap ton.
Yeah, we're talking 2 years from now. So even if this doesn't happen by the end of 2011, in another 2 years, the whole country is going to be blanketed in it. And, you know, it just makes me a little bit, you know, I like to see companies that operate this way, that reinvest in their technology. It makes them like sustainable in the long term. You know, Verizon's taken a lot of crap over the years, but I think this is proof positive that their business model is working.
Oh, I definitely agree.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm really, like, once I heard about this, I was really excited about the 4G Thunderbolt that just came out, and I'm, like, tempted to buy it, like, just to jump on it.
Don't.
Oh, okay.
I actually have somebody, a friend of mine, who has one, and he said it is the worst battery life of any phone he's ever owned.
Oh, well, that's terrible.
That, you know, that's all we have to talk about this week. Did you see anything else happening this week?
Actually, there was something, but I forget about it now, so I guess not. Yeah.
Should have emailed yourself the article.
I should have.
So that is all we have for this week's episode of the Slongcast. As usual, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter. My username is Slongcack. Ryan, if people want to get to know you, where do they go?
I'm on Twitter at slash Ryan Lancey, and also at www.lancipedia.com.
Definitely check out the Lancipedia. I like the Lance. I like the name.
It's funny, witty, and informative.
Seriously, yeah. That sounds like a tagline that you might want to have on your website.
Yeah, I might have to check into that.
Huh. Interesting. As always, if you want us to talk about a story, you find something interesting, you want to get our opinions on it, just submit it on Delicious. Bookmark it on Delicious. Our next episode will be episode 30. So tag the story Slongcast 030. And dovidzhenya.